This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, initiating an oral history interview with U.S. Army veteran William Giles. Today's date is, the 30th of June, 2005. I am on the campus of Texas Tech in the Special Collections Building, and Bill is speaking to me by telephone from San Francisco. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Bill, I'm very grateful to you for agreeing to participate in the Oral History Project and want to thank you for your time. And also, Bill, just so that we have your permission to make this available, this recording, this interview for researchers in the future, we have your permission to go ahead and do that?
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Bill. I want to begin the interview by asking you where you were born and when.
I was born on June 21st, 1942, mm-hmm. in Chicago, Illinois.
Whereabouts in Chicago?
The South Side.
Okay. Tell me a little bit, if you can, Bill, about your family's situation. What about your mom? What was her name?
My mom's name is Helvia, H-E-L-V-I-A, Giles, G-I-L-E-S. She graduated from Illinois Institute of Technology with a degree in English. And my father, William Giles, Sr., was born in Indiana, Lafayette, Indiana. And he was a pharmacist. He got his degree from Purdue University in pharmacy.
Is that right?
Uh-huh.
What year did he graduate?
1939.
Couldn't have been a lot of African-American guys in his class.
No. I think there was one other person in his class.
Is that right?
Right.
Just talking about your dad for a second, if you don't mind, was he a member of a fraternity or anything while he was there?
Yes, he was.
Which one?
It's called Alpha Psi Alpha fraternity.
Yes, sir.
And he was one of that fraternity, yes, from the Purdue University.
It seems like education was important to both your mom and dad.
Oh, yes.
Did they get that from their own individual families?
I believe so, yes.
Did you?
My grandmother was a nurse. My father's mother was a nurse. My mother's parents were from the South, from Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
And they were mostly self-employed people, but and they weren't educated, but they insisted that my mother become educated.
How many children did they have?
Which one, my mother and father?
How many children did your mom's parents have?
Oh, my mom's parents had, about 14.
Is that right?
Uh-huh. And my dad's parents had 3.
When did your mom's parents come up from Arkansas?
They didn't. I mean, they stayed there.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And my mom came up to Chicago and met my dad in Chicago, and that's when they...
Did she come up by herself?
She came up with some church group.
Is that right?
Right.
Huh. Do you know anything more about that, her trip? Did she ever tell you about it?
No, only that they met at the YMCA in Chicago, and that's about all I know. Yeah.
Interesting. And did she ever work outside the home, your mom?
Oh, yes. She worked for the federal government in Social Security. And she retired, about 20 years ago. But she worked for the federal government for all her career.
Wow. With the Social Security Administration?
Right, uh-huh.
That's cool. What about your dad now? He took that pharmacy degree.
Right. He worked mostly in hospital pharmacy. He had a stroke, when he was in his late 50s and wasn't able to work after the stroke. I think he died in the 70s.
Did he like working in the hospitals?
Oh, yes.
Do you know which hospitals he worked at?
Ooh, I don't.
Okay. It sounds like they were pretty education-oriented folks.
Oh, yes. We were all expected to go to college.
Uh-huh.
We were all expected to graduate from college and have a professional career.
How many kids in your family then?
I have a brother and a sister. My brother is a year younger than I am, and my sister is 2 years younger than I am.
So you're the oldest.
I'm the oldest.
So you had to kind of mark out the way.
Right.
Where did you go to school as a young person, elementary school and so on, Bill?
Elementary school was a Catholic school. It was, I forget the name of it. I can't even. City of the Angels, something like that.
Was this still in Chicago?
Yes, this was in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went to high school, I went to St. Elizabeth, another Catholic school. I went to St. Elizabeth High School in Chicago. And then I went to the University of Illinois School of Pharmacy and got my pharmacy degree in 1971, after I left Vietnam.
Bill, let me ask you about high school for a second.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what year did you graduate?
1960.
1960?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And were you much of a sportsman in high school?
I played a little basketball, a little football, but nothing. You know, I wasn't very – I mean, I wasn't focused on athletics. I was more focused on getting good grades.
What subjects were the most interesting to you?
Oh, anything scientific, chemistry, math, with the biology, all those type of subjects.
Did you have to work at it, Bill, or did it come pretty easily, or somewhere in between?
It came pretty easily.
Really?
Yes.
Lucky dog. So would you consider, did the other kids kind of consider you a brain box? I mean, did they think?
Right.
Yeah?
I would help them with their homework and stuff like that.
No kidding.
Yeah.
You were the go-to guy in the sciences. Were there many African Americans in the Catholic school system?
At that time, those two schools I mentioned were all black. Well, mostly, mm-hmm. majority black.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And what was the relationship of the kids with the powers that be, with say the nuns?
They were very respectful. I mean, in those days, you rose when they came into the classroom. You rose when they left the classroom. You kept quiet. It was really something that I would like to see more of today: more respect for your teachers and
mm-hmm.
others.
Mm-hmm. And so, you think that that kind of well-disciplined and ordered environment was probably a good one?
Yes, I did.
Was it a good one for you?
Yes, it was. Yes.
Did you read much outside of the sciences?
I don't recall. Oh, yes. Well, I fell in love with Shakespeare at some point in time, and I read all of his works, his plays, and his sort of Shakespeare. Yes, I did.
Did you find him on your own, or was it part of a class?
On my own.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So do you like the plays or the sonnets? Or
The plays, the tragedies mostly.
Uh-huh. Do you have a favorite?
Well, Romeo and Juliet. Well, all of us. Romeo and Juliet, Othello, King Lear. All of them.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Are you much of a theater goer, or were you ever?
Oh, I was. I would go to the theater a lot. I would go to plays, concerts. I love classical music. I studied piano when I was about 6.5 years old until I was a teenager, and then I got bored with the piano. All my friends were playing, but it was laying out there, and I was doing these piping exercises. I'm getting bored.
Right, right. Did you branch out, or did you just decide to leave it?
I just left it for a while.
Okay. Uh-huh. Did you ever come back to it?
Tried to, but that's what my therapist is trying to get me to do now, is get back to some of the things I did before.
Exactly, yeah.
Before Vietnam.
Yeah. Music might be one of those.
Oh, yes. It's the love of my life, music.
Oh, yeah. Is it really?
Yeah.
Cool. Where do your tastes go now in music?
Well, just, you know, the classicals or the plays. I've seen Les Mis about 2 or 3 times now. And plays like that, and musicals,
mm-hmm.
things like that, yes.
Sure. When you graduated from high school, Bill, if you can think back to that time, what did you see before you? Were you intent on getting into university?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. I was intent of getting into Virginia University, I was accepted into Lawrence College. I was the one of two African Americans that was admitted to the school, Lawrence College, at the time.
Which college?
L-O-R-A-S, Lawrence.
And where's that?
It's in Dubuque, Iowa.
What made you choose them?
My mother had something to do with that.
Okay.
She didn't want me to go to a black college. She wanted me to go to a Catholic college, which I did.
Why was that? Why didn't she want you to go to, like, for example, a historically black college or even one of the big public colleges in Illinois?
She seemed to be the type of person that wanted to do something different all the time.
Uh-huh.
Like, whenever we moved into a white neighborhood.
Really?
And we got a lot of grief about that, but she would always try to integrate other cultures other than just the black culture that was prevalent in Chicago.
That's interesting. Can you say anything about the grief that you guys got when?
Oh, people calling you names when you walk down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And cussing at you and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty tough.
Right.
How did you guys react? Did your parents tell you what to do when stuff like that happened?
No, I just reacted on my own. Mostly I would shout something back at them. I might be outnumbered 21, but they didn't seem to be afraid of direct confrontation. As long as they were in shouting distance, they were all right.
So they would keep a safe distance away.
Right.
What about your brother and sister? Did they take it a little bit harder than you since they were younger?
I was more like the protector of them
mm-hmm.
at that time. I was the big brother, and whenever something would happen, I would intervene. And in fact, there was one time some guys were getting ready to beat my brother, and I ran and hit them.
You hit them?
I hit them on the run, and then I just took my brother's hand, and we walked through the crowd, and everybody looked like the Red Sea parted. You know?
Really?
Walked through the area.
All white people
yeah.
in the crowd?
Right.
Anybody step forward to say anything helpful?
No.
Wow. That's really scary. About how old were you?
Ooh.
Any idea?
Let's see.
Or how old was he?
I must have been 8th grade. Maybe he was in 7th grade. I was in 8th grade. What's that?
I'm sure he was glad you were there.
Right.
I'll bet he was. So tell me about going out to Iowa, to the college.
Oh, it was another cultural experience. I mean, what do you call it? Culture shock.
I'll bet.
Because all these kids from the farms around in Iowa.
Yep.
And they seem to have preconceived notions about black people. And I seemed to, when I went there, I destroyed them all because they would study for their exams, and I would maybe just sit around and lollygag, and when the exam was over, they would always want, what grade did you get? What grade did you get? And then A or B, and they would go, oh, man, how do you do it?
And did you just kind of say nothing, or how did you handle that?
I just sort of said nothing, let them, you know, learn on their own that all people are not the same.
Mm-hmm. You had it going on
right.
in the sciences anyways,
right.
for sure. Did you make friends?
Yes. In fact, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, a friend, I think his name was Richard.
Mm-hmm.
He invited me one summer to visit his family in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and we spent a week there, and it was very, his family was very gracious, and there was just acceptance all around, and it was just a really good experience to be exposed to their family and to see that all people are not hateful and stuff.
That's good. That's very good. And that was up in Fond du Lac?
Right, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Was there any negative stuff that came at you from outside the family? I mean, when you guys would go shopping or maybe out to a restaurant or something?
No, it's pretty much I guess it's pretty much laid-back city. It was no big thing at all for me to walk down there.
Wow, that's cool. Was it good to be, in a way, out of Chicago?
Oh, yes. I was away from, my experience in Chicago was all black because the schools were black my friends were black, and so when I went to Wisconsin, when I went to Wisconsin, it was an eye opener that all people weren't the same. As,
mm-hmm.
As, it's possible to get along with everybody and then not to
It sounds like too you got some respect,
right?
From unexpected quarters, at least at college. What about the professors? How did was there anyone there that was particularly inspiring or good in the classroom?
Not that I can recall.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty much the same. It's only when I went to, in fact, the irony of all this, when I went to a professional school, University of Illinois,
mm-hmm.
that's when I ran into some professors that were really condescending.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I'll ask you about that in a sec. Did you actually take a degree then from Lawrence College?
No, I dropped out about 2 years in, and I went to school in Chicago.
Which was?
De La Salle, I think it was. De La Salle College.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a degree there, and then I applied to pharmacy school and was accepted there.
So what year did you get your first degree then? Do you?
The first degree was in 1964.
And you applied immediately on then to Illinois?
Yes.
Okay. And how many, first of all, tell me about deciding to go into pharmacy. Your father had done that.
Yes, my father had done that. And looking back on it, I was probably trying to please the family, and and that's why, because I was always expected to be a professional in the medical profession.
In the medical profession specifically?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
that's pretty heavy.
Yeah.
Was it something that you felt on your own, though, was calling you, or?
Well, looking back on it, since I've been in therapy for the last 6 or 7 years.
Yes, sir.
I realized it was not my choice. I would have much rather, done something else, maybe. But it was, I felt an obligation to carry the family's name,
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And were they glad to have you back in state?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Were your younger brother and sister going to college then, too, along this time?
Yes, my brother and sister were going to college. My brother got a degree in computer design, and he's a computer whiz.
Wow.
My sister, she became a school teacher in Chicago. She got a degree in education, primary education, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Did she continue teaching for a career?
Yes, she did. She just retired last year.
Oh, no kidding.
Right.
Wow. but she could tell some stories, too.
Oh, yes.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about the University of Illinois. What was the climate like when you got there?
It was all the stuff that was going on, with the Black Panthers and the revolution was going to start and all this. So it was mm-hmm. a really intense period of time when all these anarchists, the Black Panthers, the Black Muslims, all this was affecting a lot of what's going on, the murders in Mississippi, all that kind of
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm. Were you, did you pay a lot of attention to that, or was it on the periphery?
I paid a lot of attention to it because the Black Panther was saying that they want to kill all the bourgeois blacks because we were culturally similar to whites,
mm-hmm.
and we were deserting the black cause and stuff like that. So I was concerned about that. Plus, I was concerned about if there was a revolution, whose side would I be on?
Yeah, I mean that's confusing. I mean that's confusing stuff.
Right.
And were you grappling with that?
Right.
In your own way?
Right.
Wow. Did you ever go to any meetings or kind of?
I went to one meeting, and it was a Black Panther meeting, and they were talking about bashing white kids' heads against the wall and killing them and stuff. And I started laughing, and I had to stop laughing because two of their security guards came and stood next to me, and I got out of there as soon as possible.
That kind of straightened you up?
Right.
And you hit for the doors?
Right. I said, these people are crazy.
How many people were at a meeting like that?
I guess it was about 40 or 50 some people.
Well, I mean, was it kind of, I mean, your reaction was to laugh, which is interesting.
Right.
Was it scary on some level?
It was scary when I realized that they were taking it, I mean, it wasn't a joke. I mean, they were really serious about some of this crazy stuff. And all I could do was laugh because it was just so idiotic.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was reminded that I'm in the hospital environment and that I better keep my mouth shut and go get out of there.
Mm-hmm. there was not much attractive in their rhetoric or in their ideas for you?
No, nothing at all.
Mm-hmm. What about the Black Muslims, the Black Muslim movement?
They weren't attractive to me at all either because, like I said, we did some of the things they were talking about, and then talking about killing people and stuff, and I just didn't go along with any of that.
You weren't wired that way at all?
No.
Yeah. Did you get involved in any political or social or fraternity groups and stuff at Illinois?
I joined the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
Was called my dad.
Mm-hmm. Did that make him proud?
Well, yeah.
I'll bet it did, actually. what do you remember? What can you tell me about the chapter that you were in and the guys that you knew then?
They were very intelligent. Our academic requirements were very high.
Mm-hmm.
So they were all going to be professional people, lawyers, doctors, stuff like that. And we had a lot of fun. The Black Society of Chicago at that time was pretty close in there because, especially if you were professional, because there were not that many professionals around at that time.
That's right, yep.
It was pretty much everybody knew each other and knew the families and everything like that. It was sort of close in there.
So some of those guys, at least by family or by reputation, you already had some idea of who they were?
Right.
Wow. And what did the APA guys do for fun? Did you guys you partied?
Right.
Were there sororities on campus?
Oh, yeah.
Too?
Oh, yeah. We partied with the AKAs and Deltas.
Mm-hmm.
So there was also sororities in there. And like I said, it was pretty much close in that group because we knew each other's family by reputation, if not, you know, impersonally.
Sure. In some ways, it's interesting that there was this sorority and fraternity groups that were, you know, sort of very focused on academics and on achievement and on, you know, getting good positions and so on when they graduated. And then there was this sort of radical group,
right.
Several radical groups that you've described. Was there any interaction between them?
No.
Really?
No.
Let me ask how it happened, Bill, that you came to leave Illinois before you graduated and go into the service. Did you get draft papers? Or?
I got draft papers. I was drafted.
And this is while you were fully attending university?
Right. Yes. Uh-huh.
And so, of course, I'm going to ask, why did you not receive a deferment?
Well, at that time, I think there was not that many deferments going around. They didn't offer me
It never arose as a possibility.
No, not for me anyway.
Did you report then to the draft board?
No.
What happened?
Yeah, in 1966, I got my first draft notice.
Mm-hmm.
I moved to New York City.
I see.
In 1967, 2007, they caught me in New York City and sent me another notice. I moved back to Chicago. And then 60, that's when they sent the FBI after me. Laura threatened to send the FBI after me, and that's when I reported to the draft board.
How did you know that the FBI had gotten involved?
They sent me a letter, registered letter. And I came home that day, and my mother and my sister were in the front room, and they had this look on their face, and I said, okay, give me my draft notice.
You already knew, huh?
Yeah.
Gosh. Let me ask about what your thinking was. I think this will be interesting to students in the future. When you got the draft notice, what did you know? I mean, the first time before you moved to New York, what did you know about Vietnam? What did you think about it?
I knew there was a lot of people going over there, and there was a lot of people dying over there. And there was some protests. The war protests were just beginning.
Yes.
Just. Mm-hmm. And there was, I was, a lot of, like I said, I used to love to go to music, and in Chicago they had a lot of these coffee shop clubs where people were singing folk music and read poetry and pretty much against, you know, for peace and against war.
Sure.
You know, I hung around those kind of people, and that's where I realized that I was more in their way of thinking than anybody else's way of thinking. So I, that's what I exposed myself to, and that's where I got the feeling that Vietnam was morally wrong.
And you thought that at that point?
Yes, I did.
Did you, were there particular coffee shops or places that you would hang out and where this kind of stuff was in the air?
Yes. I can't think of the names, but there was a lot of clubs around Chicago at the time.
Were they on the south side, any of them?
They were, mostly they were what was called Midtown.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of clubs, the blues clubs, folk music clubs, all kind of clubs in that area. I can't even think of the area's name now.
That's right okay. Now. That's okay.
But it was sort of like a block of different clubs in that area.
Tell me about going to New York. How did you decide on New York?
Well, I wanted a place as big as Chicago.
Yeah.
And I thought that New York would be a nice place to go, so I went. So I caught a bus up there. I think it was on the Greyhound, yes. And I stayed at a YMCA for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be friends with anybody. I was just trying to, you know, hide out. I was just, you know, but I did make friends. And we went to the club, the folk music and the jazz and the blues clubs in New York, and it was another culture shock because New York is much faster than Chicago. I mean, you walk faster, the subways are more crowded, and it was an experience that I enjoyed.
Did you make friends out there?
Oh, yes, I did. I had a core of friends.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the people I knew, their parents worked for the United Nations. So they were French,
mm-hmm.
African, Nigerians, Dutch. You know, it was a whole slew of different type of friends, you know, from different countries with different ideas. And we would get into these philosophical discussions, and it would last all night or part of the morning. And it was really getting to know different cultures and different ways of thinking and that's what I enjoyed about being in New York.
That must have been in some ways, although you're kind of on the, you're on the lam, basically.
Right.
So a little dangerous, but you sound like you had a very good opportunity to learn a lot of things.
Right.
During that period. Were you reading a lot too, Bill?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
What kinds of things do you remember?
Oh.
Literature or?
Literature, yes. Mostly literature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What, if you can remember, Bill, what was the talk about the Vietnam War among that group of people? What were they saying about American policy?
We should get out. It was a sovereign country, and it was a civil war. It wasn't a, and we shouldn't have been involved in the civil war.
And did all that sound pretty much right to you?
Yes.
Yeah. Once you had moved back to Chicago, and your mom had basically handed over that letter, how did you decide what to do next? How did you decide to go to the draft board, essentially?
I just gave up, in a sense. I just said, well, and I still had the idea of, you know, finishing college and getting a degree, and I thought that would be compromised if I was arrested or didn't, you know, go by the rules. So I just said to Hessel that I just gave up and went to the draft board.
And is that why, for example, you didn't try to leave the country?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever consider it?
Yes, briefly, yes. But I'm, you know, close to my mother, and mm-hmm. didn't want to leave her.
This must have been tough for her, too.
Oh, yes.
Throughout.
Very much.
Go ahead.
On one of the Christmases, well, the Christmas I was in Vietnam, she was at work, and she broke down and started crying, and nobody could console her, and she was just so uncontrollable that they just almost had to hospitalize her because I was in Vietnam. Mm.
And I'm sure that incident was just kind of the culmination of a whole lot of stress and anxiety before that. Many,
right.
many months, I'm sure.
Right.
Had your brother received a draft notice?
No.
Did he ever get drafted?
He did something. Well, when he was about 16 years old, he joined the Air Force. He lied about his age and joined the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And he was such a mess up that they finally found out how old he was. They kicked him out. So they... So nobody in the service wanted him. My brother was diagnosed in his late teens with paranoid schizophrenia.
Okay.
So that's probably explained a lot of what went on with him
mm-hmm.
at that time.
So he essentially was not going to be able to serve.
Right.
Yeah. Once you had to report, can you tell me what happened?
We walked in and we walked in, and they had a physical, the so-called physical. It wasn't the physical. They just looked at you and okay, next.
Really?
Right. It wasn't, they may check your blood pressure or your heart. But even then, you know, it was next. Put us on a bus and to the train station, and then we went to Fort Campbell, Kentucky for our basic training.
How did you get down there?
I'm sure it was on the train.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember very much about your basic training?
Yes.
Can you tell me what it was like to be there?
It was cold. It was in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, yeah, October was cold. It was beginning of wintertime. And they were always yelling at you and rushing you from one place to another so you didn't have time to think. And I remember one thing I remember about basic training was when I was on Sundays, they left us alone, and Sundays I would go to the library
mm-hmm.
and play some opera or classical music and read a book at the library, and I'd be walking on this road, and this car came by me with one flag on the car
mm-hmm.
with one star on it, and I kept on walking, and then this car stopped, and the general jumps out of the car and says, whenever you see a car go like that, you're supposed to salute. And I'm going, oh, man, it's a Sunday. Go and relax in this pool. It's nothing yelling at me about saluting the damn car. So I wasn't very cooperative in basic training. It got to a point where they left me alone because what I was also doing when I went to the library was reading the Code of Military Justice and figuring out how much I could get away with before they court-martialed me.
You were?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you were not the typical recruit, not their typical draftee. And your idea was to figure out how much it would take for them to. I mean, what you would be able to do short of getting into some serious trouble.
Right.
Wow. What was the routine like? I mean, they were hurrying you around.
Early in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, they'll get you up, and we were going on either five-mile hike or something like that, and then we go to the rifle range, and then we shoot, learn how to fire weapons, and then we have bayonet training when the spirit of the bayonet is to kill. And I never would say that, and they'd get pissed off at me because I wouldn't say that.
You refused?
I refused to say the spirit of the bayonet to kill. And we would be marching along, and they would be singing these marching songs, you know, to the left, right, left.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't sing those songs because if I die in a combat zone, box me up and shift me home. I never would say that.
So were you just quiet? Did you just kind of, you know?
Mouth it, but they didn't.
Oh, okay.
They were always messing with me, but they knew I wasn't really saying it.
I wondered if you made up alternative words or, you know. That kind of thing.
Well, no.
But you were doing what you could to kind of be non-compliant.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Wow. How did you do on the rifle range and shooting and all that?
I was an expert. I was very good. But then it occurred to me. I said, "Well, what am I so proud of? They're proud of being infantry."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, did you have any say as time went on as to what your specialty would be?
No.
How did it happen that you went to?
I have no idea that how they picked these guys for.
Yeah.
I guess it's some kind of, we had a test when we went in, and I think there might be some type of personality questions on the test. And,
probably.
And they probably picked them up, you know, from that, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure about it, but most of the guys I knew were like people that were caretakers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess, the way they chose us.
Were you, what was your response or your reaction when you found out that you were actually going to go to Fort Sam for medical training?
Well, I knew that was the next step to going to Vietnam, and I probably knew then that was where I was headed for. But the training was really significant to what I experienced when I got to Vietnam.
So it was related and useful?
No.
Not at all?
Not at all.
Wow. Tell me about that. This is about Fort Sam.
Yeah. What I remember about Fort Sam is how to carry wounded, you know, on your back and how to make a hospital bed. And, you know, all this stuff. And
right.
We were not... There was nothing taught there that I could use in Vietnam.
What were they actually training you to do? I mean, within the Army's mind, what was your job going to be?
My job was to take care of the wounded. They had a triage. The Army's triage is the more severely wounded you don't treat because they'll probably die anyway. You treat the walking wounded first because they can get the weapons to go back out and fight. Pretty well, and then the moderate wounded you treat. But when we got to Vietnam, it was reversed. I mean, just human nature made it that you treated the people that were most severely hurt, and the walking wounded were treated the last.
So that seems kind of pointless then.
Yeah.
In some way. Did they give you any kind of skills that you could actually use?
No. Well, you know, we gave injections. We know how to give injections. We know how to make a hospital bed. We knew but learn how to tie a tourniquet.
Mm-hmm.
And what they call sucking breast wounds, we learned how to fill that up.
How to what?
You know, if we shot in the chest.
Yes.
You would get this suction. You lose the suction of the lungs because of the lungs would collapse.
Sure, yes.
So what we were supposed to do was take a cellophane paper and put it over the wound to keep the air from escaping. And
okay.
That never worked.
That never worked.
No.
But the idea was to be able to preserve respiration.
Right.
And allow the wounded person to continue to breathe.
Right.
And that didn't work very well.
No.
Was Fort Sam... A tough place?
Not really. It was not as tough as I thought. You know, like infantry had to.
Mm-hmm.
We had pretty much, you know, we marched around and took these classes, mostly how to give injections, how to do certain things like that. But it wasn't as intense as I thought it could have been.
Were you, once you graduated from Fort Sam, were you trained then as a hospital orderly or as a corpsman, or what was your MOS described as?
My MOS was a medic. Medic.
Okay.
And it was medic could be a hospital corpsman. The medic could be out of, in the field.
So you were thinking that it was possible that you would be out on maneuvers with troops.
Right.
Okay, and what did they train you for that was specific to that kind of work, if anything? I mean,
I don't mean like how to carry a wounded person, you know, a fireman's carry where you carry them over your back, or you drag them down, you know.
Sure.
Put their arms around you and you drag them.
Yep.
Like crawling.
Yep.
Those things, that's the little.
Did they teach you about, for example, how to do pain medications and stuff like that?
Oh, no. That was only when we got to Vietnam that we learned about the morphine injections that they had.
Really?
And those injections, you could just go right through the clothing and inject morphine. But they took it away from us while I was in Vietnam because all the medicine. Using morphine to get high with.
Is that right? Yeah.
Right.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Well, tell me first, before we get there, about going out to Vietnam. Did you get to go home first?
Yes, we went. I think it was a week. I'm not sure, but of course, time is sort of distorted right now.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure. I mean, that had to be hard, though.
Yeah, we were there a week. Then I got a plane to, I guess they gave me a ticket to go to Open.
Mm-hmm.
And I got on a plane at Open and we flew out to Vietnam.
Do you remember arriving?
Yes.
Well, can you tell me anything about it?
I was scared shitless.
Really?
That's when the fear started kicking in. I figured that the moment we landed, there would be a town in the area would be aiming their gun right at me. Nobody else but me. Blow me away the moment I stepped off the plane.
Wow.
So.
I'm sure you weren't alone thinking that.
Right.
Getting off the plane and when you know, nobody did shoot you, did you sense any kind of relief, or was it all just pretty frightening?
It was all pretty frightening because, like a lot of the veterans say, you know, when you start landing in Vietnam, it's a beautiful country. It's green and lush forests and stuff. And you don't believe that the war is going on now, man, until you land and then you see military vehicles. Everybody has a rifle, but they haven't issued me a gun yet. So I'm standing there.
Yeah, go ahead and hand that over anytime. I can well imagine. Well, did you arrive at Tan Sanhut? I'm just assuming that you did.
I believe so, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, so down by Saigon.
Right.
And did you get picked up by somebody? Did you already know where you were on your way to?
We had to report to a office,
mm-hmm.
and they would tell you where you want to go. They would look up your records and tell you where you're going to go, and then they would call whoever was transportation from that area, and they'd come pick you up and just drive you down there.
Is that what happened with you?
Yeah. So about the third day, I got my assignment, and then they came and picked me up in a Jeep, and we're going on Highway 1 up from Saigon to Cu Chi, and I still don't have a weapon there. Everybody's armed, and they're telling me all these damn war stories, you know.
Right.
And I finally get to the point where I said, I'm not going to listen to any more of their war stories. But if they duck, I'm going to duck. If they run, I'm going to run. Because, mm-hmm. you know, they were combat ready, and I wasn't.
Yeah, you were just going to watch what they did.
Right.
Right. Did anything else happen? Anything on the trip up to Coochie?
Well, there was a Viet Cong sniper that they had hanging from a tree, and he had been dead for a month or so, and they just left his body up there for, I guess, to intimidate the other VCs or whatever. So that's the first dead body I saw. Combat, you know, wounds.
That's pretty horrific.
Yep.
Wow. What did the other guys on the truck kind of point it out and say, check it out?
Look at this guy. That's what we've written up there for a month, and they were very proud of it. It was one of their, you know, war stories again.
Yeah.
That I decided not to listen to anymore.
Gosh. That's kind of harrowing to even hear about it. What about arriving at the 12th EVAC? Now, did they take you directly to the compound, or?
Yes, we went directly to the compound and checked in with the company commander and was assigned the emergency room. Emergency room. And my hours were, you know, we worked 12 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
I realized now how tired I was. I was extremely tired the whole year I was in Vietnam. I couldn't really realize this because I was so busy all the time. But now I realize how 12 hours a day, sometimes 24 hours a day, you know.
Did you have a proper place to sleep the hours that you were off?
Yeah, you could, there was a what we call a Quonset hut.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just basically just keep laying out. But and then we built a bunker in the back so that when we had incoming rounds, we could jump in the bunker and hopefully not get hit by one of these rounds.
How soon after you got there did you have to start pulling shifts?
Immediately. And the next day I was in the emergency room, taking care of wounded. But initially it was in that battery, you know, 2-3 a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just stood up just before Tet, the Tet offensive.
Mm. Yes, sir.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
Man, so after Tet, it was just outrageous, just 20, 30 way people a day.
Can you tell me about Before the actual Tet offensive began, you guys started to get increasing numbers of casualties.
Right.
What kinds of wounds were they? What was
the gunshot wounds?
Okay.
Or shrapnel.
Uh-huh.
We were talking about this. Some of the veterans and myself were talking about the guys getting wounded now in Iraq are not getting wounded by gunshot wounds. They're getting bombed, you know, and these kids are just getting traumatic amputations all over the place.
Yep.
And for kids, I don't know. I think theirs is worse than ours because of these suicide bombers attacks.
Yeah. That does that stuff, hearing about what's happening now, does that bother you and send you?
Oh yes, definitely. Yes.
Yeah, it just kind of parallels
right
everything and. It makes it more difficult. I'm sure that it does. It won't surprise you, Bill. Other people that I'm interviewing and talking to are saying the same thing. That's just very tough to hear about that stuff, and that it unearths stuff that, you know, they haven't thought about in a long time. It makes
right.
it very difficult.
Right.
Bill, let me ask you about the people that you were working with in the ER. The orderlies, the other medics,
nurses,
doctors, mostly nurses that you saw?
They're mostly nurses, yeah.
How did you get along with them, and how did they get along with you?
Well, I made a conscious decision when I got to Vietnam that I would have no friends. And I guess that's basically because I didn't want to, you know, grieve for anybody who might be killed or lose. So I was very hostile in Vietnam. I would, somebody would say good morning to me, I'd say, fuck you.
Really?
Get out of my face. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I said, fuck you, get out of my face, or stuff like that. And people left me alone. You know, they just said, you know. And especially, you know, when I got as good as I became treating wounded, they just let me work. And they just didn't, you know, give me that.
They just let you get on with it?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then put me in, you know, BS, you know, like guard duty. They wouldn't let me, I didn't have to do guard duties or stuff like that, which was stupid to me because you do guard duty and we're in the middle of the compound. They had to go come past with the infantry divisions and the armored divisions and to get up. Guess
right.
What?
Right. Yeah, it doesn't, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Right.
Did anybody, do you think, figure out why you were acting the way you were? Did anybody try to figure it out?
No, I don't think. Well, a couple of guys, you know, when the new guy comes in and they're greeted by the people that have been there for a while,
mm-hmm.
they will warn them to leave me alone because I was not someone we could be friends with or anybody, you know, you could talk to about insignificant things about.
Right. You weren't kind of laughing and joking and hanging out.
Not at all. Mm-hmm. No.
And you said you were essentially doing this. You were trying to protect yourself.
Right. Exactly.
Do you think it worked? Did it make it harder for you?
It worked in Vietnam, but it made it harder for me when I got out.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
It was something that we're still grappling with, the fact that I had to suppress all of these emotions that I thought were dangerous to have in Vietnam. Some of them are still suppressed, and then
mm-hmm.
it's not doing me any good right now, but causes a relationship problems. It's
mm-hmm.
causes a lot of problems that people with PTSD have.
Right. Was there anybody that you did kind of let in at all over there or not?
Mm-hmm. The girl that died, the little girl that died, I let her in, and she made me cry.
Do you feel like you can tell me anything about her?
She was the 70-year-old girl that I wrote the poem about.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. That's in your letters.
Right.
Right. For someone who doesn't have access to your letters or hasn't read them yet, can you just say a word or two about her?
She was napalm. She had napalm burns over a large percentage of her body, 50% of her body.
Mm-hmm.
And she would be sitting in front of the ward. She was being treated in the hospital, and she would sit by the ward, and when she saw me, she started smiling and laughing because I would try to talk to her in Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, G.I. number 10, and she laughed. And so one time I was, and this is when I was working at NICE.
Right.
And I had to count, one of my duties was to count the beds so I could call into the headquarters and tell them how many beds we had available in case of a mass casualty, you know how many people take care of.
Yes.
So as in the process of counting these beds, I came to her bed, and she was lying there with a sheet pulled over her.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at her, and I just walked over to the bed and picked her up. And the nurse, and I think one of the corpsmen was going to come and stop me, and the other nurse, the senior nurse, said, leave him alone.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked outside. It was dark, pitch dark outside, and I was walking with her, and I was apologizing to her, and I was crying, and I was saying, I'm sorry we did this to you. And I carried her out to what's called the Conex, where we put their bodies in and wait for grazing and registration to pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
And I carried her there, and I laid her in there, and I just, and just in the emergency room, just sat there, and I guess that's when I started writing the poem I have about her. And that was the first time I cried in Vietnam, and I cried one more time in Vietnam, and that was the last time I cried since.
Is that right?
Right.
Bill, let me ask about the routine. On days when you did not have mass cows, and this is before the Tet Offensive, did you kind of get into a rhythm of doing the kinds of maintenance activities and getting supplies out and all that kind of stuff, and you just got on with it?
Basically, I remember reading a lot. That's why my then girlfriend sent me a ton of books.
Did she really?
So I remember reading a lot. I remember the routine of, you know, going to work and just sitting there and waiting for something bad to happen.
Is that how you felt most of the time?
Yes. I was scared 24 hours a day. I mean, and I didn't sleep that well either.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you didn't.
Because when I first, coming around, your initial reaction is to run, and then your higher brain level says, where?
Right, exactly.
So you just stand there and try to take it, and hopefully it won't hit you.
How many nights in a week would you guys take a shell at night?
Five nights.
Mm-hmm. I mean that's...
It was common. I mean, it was, you know...
Yeah.
When the sun went down, the rockets started coming in, the mortars and rockets started coming in.
Did you work at nights partly because you were going to be up anyways? Or how did that happen?
Well, let's see, how did that happen? I worked, I was, like the helicopter pilot told me, I was always there when they landed. So I was, unless it was just one or two casualties a day, I was there. I mean, I was overcompensating, they tell me now. I was in the OR, I was in the emergency room, I was helping out in the medevac, I was taking people off the helicopters that were shot up stuff. I was saving a guy named Frenchie. He was a helicopter gunman, and he came, he's from Lisbon, Connecticut, and came all the way to San Francisco to meet me and talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to, you know, avoid meeting him, but finally they set up a meeting, and I met with him, and he came and thanked me for saving his life. And I'm saying, there were so many, I don't know, I can't remember you. He said, I remember you, and I want to just say thank you for saving my life. And that was one of the things that got me into therapy, realizing that I had done some good, although I had lost a lot of people out there.
When did he come to see you, Bill?
Oh, about 3 years ago.
No kidding. That must have been, I mean, I hear you that it changed something for you. But when it actually happened, it must have been really intense. It was a good thing for him to do.
Yeah.
Are you in contact with him yet?
No, just one time.
Mm-hmm. But it did help you kind of see the experience a little differently.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I
wasn't a failure.
I'm sorry, what?
I wasn't a failure.
No, I think you absolutely were not. There are a lot of people who are alive or better off than they would have been if you had not been there. I'm absolutely sure of that. Bill, what can you tell me about the Tet Offensive period? Can you describe how things started to escalate?
It was just escalated. They tried to overrun the base camp. That was that's when we knew they were serious. Because they tried to overrun the base camp, and that's when that's the one and only time I came close to shooting or firing a weapon.
What happened that? Was it at night?
It was at night, and they hit the main gate first, and they were running through the main gate toward our position. And I had to load the M14 ready to fire, and just before I could do anything like that, the wounded started coming in.
Oh, is that right?
So it was just like the armored personnel carriers, it was just stacked with bodies, and I was up there pulling off the body, busting body after body, and finally finding somebody who was alive, and then put them on a stretcher and take them into, and then go through the bodies again, and to find somebody else who was alive, and blood everywhere, blood.
Mm-hmm.
People screaming, people begging people grabbing my arm and asking me to help them, and it was just chaos. And so I just put my weapon away and just started trying to save as many people as I could.
Any idea, Bill, how many people you worked with through that period? Do any of them stand out in your mind?
Are you talking about the personnel at the hospital?
Yeah. No, I mean actually the people that you were treating, the people that you were working on.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of wounded guys who were asking me to tell their parents some, you know, things like I love you and other things. They would hold my arm and I would hold their hands. And during that time when I was holding their hands, I knew they were going to die soon. I was holding their hands so that when the spirit left, when the living spirit left them, they would come through them to me, and they would live within me as long as I was alive. Which sounded like a good idea at the time, which I'm paying the price for right now, trying to send them away so I can live again.
Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah. There was about, I guess, 50 to 100 people died. Just before they died, I held their hands and kind of wished their spirit into me.
Bill,
and,
I mean, that's... Bill, were you able to... After this whole chaotic period, and I know things continued on, you guys continued
right.
to get a lot of casualties
right.
for several months.
Right.
Was there anything that you could do to make yourself sort of feel more kind of whole and integrated? Did you have any tools at all? Or
no.
Okay.
No.
Did reading help?
It just helped get my mind off the little going on around me. To a little degree.
What about your letters that you were writing and receiving? How important were they?
Looking back on it, I realized I was writing those letters to my ex-girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
I was writing those letters to myself. And I used her name just to have them, you know, preserved. So I told her to never throw these letters away because I think I want to know what's going on. I think that kind of helped me get through a lot of the what I was going through at the time, writing those letters. Reading them now when I have a chance, which is difficult for me to do still, but reading them now, I realize how much emotion I had to stuff in order to get the job done, and how even though I was acting like a bad guy, how really I was a spiritual person with these men. I say in the letter, I love them. I love these guys that were wounded. And, it wasn't, I don't know how to express the love, but it was, I guess the love of mankind, I guess, I don't know.
Well, I also sense that, you know, you felt that, and maybe I'm wrong, you can correct me, that this wasn't a good thing for us to be doing. I mean,
no.
you were questioning already long before you got over there
right.
whether we should be there at all.
Right.
Did your sense of the, I don't know, you called it not a moral investment by the United States. I mean, did your sense of this kind of injustice, did it harden up while you were there? Because of all the suffering that you saw?
I believe so, yes. Yes.
Yeah. I would think it would. Did you ever get out of Coochie the whole year you were there from, what, September 67 to 68? Did you ever get out of Coochie?
I used to go once a month. They made me, because I was so good, they made me the casualty clerk. So I had to account for all the casualties that the 25th Infantry Division had during the month period.
Mm-hmm.
So once a month, I would go to the Long Bend with the headquarters of the Army, and I would hand them out casualty reports. And that's I could be gone for maybe a couple of days. That's the only time I left Coochie.
What were things like over at Long Bend?
It was like a country club. I mean, it's got, they had live shows. They had hot or cold running water. They had toilets that flushed. They had girls that, you know, doing shows. They had a cafeteria. I took a hot shower for the first time in months.
Oh, geez.
And just didn't want to get out of the shower. It was like a country club. A lot of people resented it because the guys that were in the field and people like, and folks like Kuchi, like where I was, we were just flabbergasted by the way they lived.
Wow. Was there resentment?
Yes.
Did you feel any of that?
Yes. Because I would come in, I'd get off the helicopter and come in and give my reports, and then I was carrying a weapon. I had a .45 on my hip,
uh-huh.
And my shoes were dirty, and my uniform wrinkled, and these guys were spit shine shoes and iron uniforms and all this other good stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what else were we doing? We resented the guys when we had to be out there, and they were living the life of it.
Yeah.
Of these.
Yeah. Was there resentment on top of that or parallel to that?
I heard a lot of reports about drugs. But most of that was in the areas like Long Venice, where they were having, they had racial, I understand they had some racial complex there too, but again, I was in Long Bend. We didn't have racial conflict where we were because we were all worrying about living and dying. We weren't worried about who was black or white, or who was like, who could better take care of us, who was trust behind us, or who was on our back.
You guys were under threat all the time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Did you see, though, Bill, people who were taking advantage in some way of the availability of drugs and stuff in the hospitals to kind of, you know, either party or ease out or whatever?
Mostly ease out, but I, like I said, most people I dealt with were people in the combat, really in the combat area. So we didn't, I mean, I wouldn't smoke marijuana because I couldn't trust myself to get high because you never know when some casualties come in, and I was always needed to be sober before that, so I wouldn't smoke marijuana, I wouldn't take drugs, I wouldn't drink a little bit, but I wasn't gonna be drunk because I wanted to be there for the guys when they came in.
You didn't want to be out of control.
Right.
Wow. Or and unable to do something for something. Right. What in Coochie, from whatever you observed, what would you say was the drug of choice? What was easiest to get hold of?
It's marijuana or tie sticks. That was it.
Really?
Everybody.
Everybody?
Yeah, they would walk down the street like they're smoking a cigarette and be a joint.
Mm-hmm. Did that worry you? That, I mean, other people were doing that, and this is a combat area.
No, I pretty much relied on myself. I figured, you know, I didn't rely, like I said, I didn't have any friends in Vietnam, so I didn't.
Yeah.
I just relied on myself. I would, if necessary, I was on a patrol or something. I don't remember what, but we were supposed to be quiet at night. And these guys were talking like it was a walk in the park. And I'm telling them, you know, shut up.
Mm-hmm.
they sit up for a while, and then they start talking again. And I said, shut up. And they stopped talking for a while, and then they start talking again. And that's when I locked and loaded my weapon, and they heard that, and they shut up.
Did you have to do that a couple, three times?
Well, they knew I would, and they put my life in jeopardy. I would have shot them.
You would have?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's my main thing was survival.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only emotion I expressed while I was in Vietnam was survival. I didn't care about having to go to the bathroom. I didn't care if I hadn't eaten in 2 days. I didn't care if I hadn't. Well, all the mundane things, you know.
Sure. But you were totally focused.
Focused on surviving.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have access to music at all?
No, I don't. Oh, guys had their got these cassette players and stuff like that when we were over there.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't listen to their music.
Did anybody, for example, try to, I don't know, get you involved in anything, or did they pretty much just kind of give you your own space?
Right, they didn't give them their own space.
Wow. When did the casualty flow into the hospital start to let down, or did it after the Tet Offensive?
I was thinking after the Tet, it was February, March, April.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
They had a May offensive, too.
Yes, uh-huh, they did.
And it was as bad or if not worse than the Tet Offensive, but nobody said anything about that. So it was pretty steady until the May offensive. It went down a little bit, and then they had a May offensive, and we got swamped again. May, June, July, August, September, October. I had 5 months left.
Yeah.
And that was, I can't recall it being, ever going down to what it was when I first got there. It was always 20 or 30 guys, and it never went back down to the, you know, one or two guys a day.
Bill, what, in the ER, when you were doing triage, what were the worst wounds, the wounds you knew these guys were not going to make it? What were those caused by?
Traumatic amputations. The guys that have lost both their feet or arms and legs, and these are guys that, you know, just lost so much quantity of blood.
And
it was something I used to write on. I wrote the death certificates, and the doctor would sign them, but I was the one that wrote the death certificate. And exsanguination, I remember that word. I never saw that word before Vietnam. I never heard of it since Vietnam. But exsanguination is bleeding to death.
Yeah.
And that's the cause of death. I was putting on that, exsanguination.
Did you have to work with the Graves Registration people then?
Only when it came to the bodies.
I mean, do you have any idea how they were handling what they were doing?
No, I don't.
Did you talk to them at all or not? Not really.
Not really. I know that now that they're one of the group of people with the most PTSD because they saw all these. Well, for example, I'm casualty clerk now, and I have access to all the casualty reports and how many people were killed during the week and the month, all during the month.
Yes.
And I come to realize that over that 1 year period of time, I saw at least 500 GIs that are dying and about 3 times that many Vietnamese civilian casualties. So.
Did you ever have VC come in to the,
yes,
for treatment?
Yes.
How'd that go?
This guy was wounded in the leg. He was, and the doctors were asking for an x-ray. And the X-ray technicians who were drug addicts or potters or whatever, they were trying to cause this guy pain. I mean, they were slamming his leg and twisting his leg and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked up to him and said, if you feel that damn brave, why don't you just get a weapon and walk outside and show how brave you really are? And that's when they stopped.
They stopped.
And they stopped and gave me a dirty look. And they were going to give me a dirty look in Vietnam, so I didn't really give a damn.
Right, sure.
So that's things like that, you know, when one colonel came in and he was a charge of artillery and they had a short round and they hit his own men.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in there apologizing to the men that were wounded. I walked up to him and said, why don't you go and apologize to the other ones outside? He looked at me and then he went up to the head of the hospital and I could see them looking at me and talking. I guess they had a hospital said, that's Bill, just leave him alone.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm.
So you had a reputation that pretty much everybody there, even all the way up to the top,
right,
had, they knew, well, that's Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Did you see other allies of the United States come through there at all? Any Australians?
Not that I can recall.
Koreans?
No.
Okay. Did you have any kind of opinion about the Viet Cong. Clearly, those X-ray tech guys were pissed off at at the enemy and wanted to take it out on this one guy and and so on. Did you have opinions about this? I mean, I know earlier you had said, you know, look, this was a civil war, and
I'm
not sure we should even be here.
I heard a lot of, you know, about their atrocities from the, you know, from the grapevine, you know, the BC had just come to this village and even Coochie, village of Coochie, they came to the defenses.
Yeah.
They killed some of the village people.
Right.
So I knew that they were, what they were capable of, but again, I didn't think it was fair to try to make one man suffer for the whole country.
And in some way, was that what it was about for you? I mean, was being fair and trying to be honorable? And
right.
That's sort of what it sounds like.
Right.
Bill, do you remember counting the time until you were going to be out of there?
Yes, but the funny thing about that was that the mama-san, the lady that took care of our hooch.
Yes.
I was sitting there one day, and she came up to me. She said, "You leave soon. You leave 2 months from now." And I said, "I do?" And I have completely forgotten about it. And she reminded me about it. And I'm going, how does she know? I mean, but I don't know. I just, so she wrote me a letter. And she's, in her letter, she's, I can't remember the exact words, but the gist of the letter was that she hoped that me and my family would have a prosperous life, and that she would, that I would think about her when I could. And it was a nice letter, something along those lines. And I wrote back to her that it was all translated by a interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote back to her that I was glad to have met her, and that I hope that she and her family have a good life, and that this war will end soon, and that they could go back being where they were.
Sounds like she didn't hate you.
No.
She probably, there's something there. She liked you. Bill, can you tell me about getting out of Coochie and getting ready to get out of Vietnam?
I had access to the pharmacy because I was a medic.
Right.
And they had sleeping pills in the pharmacy.
Uh-huh.
And I took, they were pretty powerful sleeping pills, and I took three of them. I took three of them and put them in my pocket.
Right.
So when we got to Tansanoo, when we were getting ready to take off, we were hit. I mean, we had incoming rounds and they just left off some fresh troops, and they would run around, didn't know where to go, and the seasoned troops, the guys that were going out of there, we were pulling them down and telling them, stay down, don't run around, just stay down. And finally, we got into the plane, and the pilot said, "You want to wait till the all clear? You want to take off?" We said, "Take off."
Yeah.
Get the hell out of here.
Sure.
So we took off, and when I was high enough to know that there was no BC rocket that could reach the plane, I took one sleeping pill, and I slept from Vietnam to Okinawa. And then we landed in Okinawa, refueled, and I slept from Okinawa to, I took the other pill, and I slept from Okinawa to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And we reached Hawaii, and we uploaded and filled up, and I slept from, I took the third pill and slept from Hawaii to Oakland. So when I got to Oakland, it was a bad dream. It was like it was a nightmare. It was like it was a dream that never happened. Which I didn't fool anybody but myself.
Did you have any trouble getting from Oakland home?
No. I just got a plane in San Francisco and flew back to Chicago.
Anything going on at the airport in the way of protesters or people looking at you funny or any of that?
Oh, no.
Nothing?
Not me, no.
Uh-huh.
Well, a lot of those guys, they went and changed out of their uniforms normally when we landed in Oakland. Went to the bathroom and changed uniforms.
Did you do that?
No, I didn't do that.
Why not, do you think?
I don't know. I heard about all the stuff that was going on, but I just didn't. And plus, in my circle of friends in the Chicago, the South Side of Chicago, everybody was glad to see me. There was none of this baby killer and all that kind of stuff. I didn't experience it. But I was in a different, space and time. I was insulated by my family and friends.
Mm-hmm. All of whom were just probably damn glad to see you back.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. How did your parents react? Did they just take you right in, like everything was good?
Oh yeah, my mother. Well, for a while.
Okay.
My mother was glad to see me. She hugged and kissed me, which was that lasted for about 2 months, and then she said, "When are you gonna go back to school? When are you gonna do this? You're okay now. You don't need to be." And I'm still, having those horrible nightmares and. She came in one night one day when she was going to work, and she leaned over and kissed me on the forehead. And I jumped up, and I had my hand back to hit her, and she screamed. That's the only thing that woke me up, because I was, mm-hmm. Somebody was trying to speak up on me in Vietnam again.
Mm-hmm.
But, they were glad. Everybody was glad to see me. The thing, when I got to Oakland, they wanted me to talk to a re-up sergeant. I said, "Man, you out of your mind? no way I'm going to re-up on this stuff." And they insisted that they weren't going to sign me out until I talked to this re-up sergeant. So I went in and he started talking. I said, "You can say anything you want to say. I am not re-upping." But he finally stamped me and let me go.
Did you still have some duty service time left when you got back to Chicago?
No, I got off early. I got out early because I had a month left when I got it.
Okay.
So they just said, 4 months, go home.
And this was the fall of 68.
Right.
Did you in fact go right back to school?
Well, January 69.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the school pharmacy and I had my GI Bill by. GI Bill with me, and I showed him my GI Bill, and I told him I wanted to start school. He said, "Well, start school in January." And he took the GI Bill and was out of the way, and that's when I started back to January of 69, and 2 years later, 71, I got my degree in pharmacy.
And during that period, I know that you were, I'm sure, studying and trying to get all that complicated stuff into your head. But also, as you know, the whole anti-war movement just exploded during that period.
Right.
And especially after the U.S. sent troops into Cambodia, which was down in your neck of the woods in Vietnam. How did you feel about all that stuff? Did you get involved in it at all?
I did. The one time I got involved was when those kids were killed in Kent State.
Yeah.
And I did the protest. I was telling the people, all the University of Illinois, the pharmacy school, the dental school, the nursing school, and the medical school, we all got together and protested the killing of those kids. So my way of thinking, if they could kill middle-class white kids like that, there's nothing that they wouldn't do.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's one time I did march, but most of the time I was, I was telling people, they asked me, how do I get through school with all these quiet times when they would have these flashbacks and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, what I realized, I had the TV set on, I had the radio on, I had everything to distract me and not focusing on the lessons so that I wouldn't let anything outside of that come in. I was like, when I would have my, when it would come in before I go to sleep, and that's why I didn't sleep well for years. Still not sleeping well, but anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That's when it would affect me, when I was asleep.
I mean, just on that, for other veterans and people who are trying to understand this PTSD phenomenon, I mean, is it to some degree that you're afraid to go to sleep? I mean, is it?
Well, I had this one-on-one, and I've come to learn that one-on-one therapy.
Sure.
And what I've come to learn is that, a year, my I've been used to anticipating the nightfall. And
anticipating the what, Bill?
Nightfall.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing this for a year. Now, when I come back to the real world, as we called it, my brain is still working on that cycle of, you know, nighttime. It's dangerous. I wouldn't go out at night. I realized I was afraid of the night because I had this condition to be afraid of the night. And that's one way it affects me. And then I couldn't sleep at night because that's a dangerous time. And so I would barely sleep until the dawn was breaking. That's when I would go into a deep sleep. But then it was too late, so I had to go get up in about 2 or 3 more hours.
To go to work.
Right.
Right. And you did work as a pharmacist all those years.
Yes.
Where did you work, Bill?
When I graduated, I worked at for a local pharmacy, Duncan Pharmacy, small pharmacy. And then I moved out here. I was working at Letterman Hospital, and that was interesting because that was a lot of Vietnam casualties came in through there. And then after I left, I owned my own store after that for about 10 years. And Walgreens moved next door, and I had to leave there. And then I worked at mostly hospital pharmacies after that, clinics and hospital pharmacies.
So you got crushed by Walgreens.
Right.
Wow. Can I ask why you decided to move out to California?
Well, my mother had moved out here, and we used to come and visit my ex-wife and I.
Mm-hmm.
And the weather was so nice, and Chicago was, well, I was tired of Chicago winters and stuff. So,
oh, sure, yeah.
So I applied for a letter in the hospital, and since I was given a priority because I was a Vietnam veteran. So they hired me, and they flew me out. I mean, they moved me out here, and they paid for all the moving and stuff.
Really?
So that's how I got out here.
Did you have any feelings about the fact that Vietnam veterans got some degree of preference in hiring, at least according to the letter of the law? Did you feel like that was a good policy, good benefit?
I thought it was good. Because we didn't have many of the theme songs for us. The GI Bill was not as good as GI Bills in the past. And we weren't respected as we were always looked at as the loser of the war, which we weren't. But I thought it was good that they recognized us at least a little bit.
How about the broader issue of the Veterans Administration and how it's handled the different demands?
From my understanding now, well, when I first got back to Chicago, I went to a psychiatrist with the VA,
mm-hmm.
and they gave me a bunch of tests, and then they came out and said, well, your IQ is such that you can do anything you want to do, and if you were crazy before you went to Vietnam, if you were crazy after you left Vietnam, you're probably crazy before you went.
Mm-hmm.
I almost grabbed him and went to college. But I said, no, man, that's the last time I contacted the VA. I made my life's mission to stay away from the VA. Later on, when I went through this clinical depression, I was walking, they had what they call a off-site clinic, you know.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I was walking by there, and I walked in and I started talking to this guy, and this guy said, you have PTSD? After we talked for about an hour, he said, you have PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, really? He said, yeah, and I was glad it was diagnosed now. If it hadn't been for the outreach program, I would have never gone into the VA system again. And now they're much more respectful for Vietnam vets in there. You know, they don't give us all crap that they gave us to when we were first sent us in the system, and it's helped.
It has helped.
Yeah.
And And are you doing some of the therapy that you mentioned? Are you doing some of that through the VA?
Yes, I'm doing all of it through the VA.
All of it, okay.
I have two groups and soon to be one-on-one. One group is the group of medics and corpsmen, which when I first started the group was a revelation that people felt the same way I did about certain things, you know, how the loss. We never talk about the people we say we are. We always talk about the people we lost.
Mm-hmm.
And my nephew, he joined the Navy about a year ago, and he wanted to be like his Uncle Bill. And so he's been training to be a corpsman. I'm going, oh, man.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Is he proud of you, do you think?
Yeah.
That's cool.
I don't know. I mean, you know, he gets in there to rock crack and see all those amputees and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's his own way to go in a way.
Right.
You know,
right.
He's seen something in you. And is he likely to go to the Middle East?
I'm hoping or not, but he probably will.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'll do, the moment he comes back, I'm going to take him by the hand and go to the VA hospital and,
yep.
And get him in therapy right away.
Get him lined up. Get him
right.
Enrolled.
Right.
Bill, you sort of alluded to this before, but I wonder if you could say a few words about the thought that I'm sure you've given over the years to U.S. involvement in Vietnam, not only your own involvement, but whether it was a good idea. Whether there was anything to have been accomplished.
Looking back on the history, and I've studied the history of Vietnam, and I know what happened after World War II and the French. They kicked the French out, and then we got involved, Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
No reason for us to be in there at all. Ho Chi Minh, if we had talked to him, wanted to be our friends, wanted to be like us, or at least, you know, not our enemy.
Mm-hmm.
We're the ones that wouldn't talk to Ho Chi Minh. We're the ones that went on our own accord into that country, which could have been a whole different scenario had we negotiated and talked to Ho Chi Minh and his people. That's my opinion.
How do you think, just kind of, you know, your own observations, how do you think the U.S. could have made that big a mistake?
The domino theory, the Cold War
mm-hmm.
thing that started after World War II. If we lost Vietnam, and we would lose Thailand, and we would lose Cambodia, and we would lose. In fact, we did lose those people, but not because of what we did in those countries. The CIA, I was exposed to the CIA in Vietnam a couple of times, and they didn't impress me. They didn't impress me as being very smart people.
What did you encounter there?
Arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
Know-it-all. They think they know it all. Even the officers in the military were sort of in all these guys, and I wasn't impressed at all. They were arrogant. They thought they knew it all, and they didn't know crap.
And the consequences of that were, of course, enormous, huge.
Right.
Do you see then parallels with contemporary policy in Iraq, for example?
Well, I don't like President Bush. I'm not saying that's the easiest thing for me to say, and I don't think a lot of Vietnam vets like him.
Mm-hmm.
He went into Iraq for one reason and one reason only, was Saddam Hussein tried to kill his father once. And he's going to get it even with Solomon for putting a contract out on his father. So he was going to go to war. The moment he was elected president, he was going to go to war in Iraq. There's no doubt about it. And 9/11 just gave him an excuse. And he doesn't see, I mean, he doesn't have the, doesn't seem to have the conscience to feel guilty about sending all these people out to die. And casualties that the Iraqi people suffer.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's hopeless as far as I'm concerned. It's something that will only be remedied when we get him out of office.
Do you see any similarities between all of this, you know, us sending tens and tens of thousands of troops over to Iraq, and now it's, I mean, certain leaders in the Senate have gone, you know, come out and said, you know, Iraq is a quagmire.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, does this ring bells for you about the Vietnam situation?
Right, it does.
Yeah. And that, I'm sure, Bill, has to be tough and trying for you, given, you know, your own personal involvements. And
yeah, I see these, I mean, I look at these soldiers in there. To me, they're kids. And I know how much I had to grow up in combat, and I know these kids going out there, they're all gun-ho and stuff. But the moment they see their first casualty, it's going to change that real quick.
You mentioned in the group work that you've been doing that you're talking to other medics and corpsmen from the Vietnam period. Are there other people that you're talking to who were at Kuchi?
Early on, there was a couple of nurses that was in the group. Mm-hmm. The group like that had doctors, medics, nurses, and all. And two of the nurses were from further back Kuchi.
Your same time period or different time?
No, different time periods. They were there. We found out that we were just missed each other by months.
Does it make a difference to you to speak with not just Vietnam veterans, but people who were trying to be caregivers over there? Does it make a different exchange?
No. No, the nurses said, well, I understand the nurses went through a lot of stuff. I mean, I'm not going to be sexist now, but the feminine qualities are caring and they also pushed to the limit in Vietnam, and a lot of these nurses broke down.
Yes, they did.
And even some of us men broke down.
That's right.
So I understand. I'll talk to one officer who was not involved as the medic.
Mm-hmm.
He was the leader of a group of guys, and he made me realize that they were scared too. I mean, these officers, the field officers, they were scared too. They didn't know it all. They were just trying to get their men out of there without getting anybody killed. So it made me realize that no, all the officers were going fast. Most of them were, not all of them.
Right, but some of them, you say, it's just like you said earlier that you know not everybody's the same.
Mm.
Bill, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you would like to contribute? Any observations or insights either about your own experience or about the conflict in general?
Well, the only thing I say it with all the convictions that I can muster is that when people come back from war, they should be debriefed. They should be taken care of. They should be reintegrated into society. And unless we do that, then we're going to have a lot of more casualties down the road. So my hope is that they tell these kids that's coming out now about the VA system and how to use it and how to let go of those emotions of hate and war and stuff and learn to reintegrate into a society of love and peace.
Bill, do you think you would have been better off if somebody had tried to help with that transition for you?
Yes, they would have. It took me 30 years to get to seek help at running with the VA, the initial running.
Right.
I would have made better choices of mates.
Mm-hmm.
I would have enjoyed life. I've been hesitant to enjoy life because of so many people that die won't have had that chance to enjoy life.
Mm-hmm.
People that I felt I could have saved. So now I realize I couldn't save anybody. I probably knew that intellectually, but emotionally I tried to save them all.
Right, and you paid a pretty heavy price for it.
Right.
But it seems from what you said that things are looking up now.
Right.
And do you feel optimistic at all about the future, your future?
Yes, I'm going to go out and start going to more plays and going to more jazz clubs and symphonies, and start enjoying life, having, you know, what's left of my life, and enjoy it.
And having your good self back.
Right.
Well, Bill, thanks for doing this interview. I appreciate it very much.
Okay.